Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, the start of another beautiful week here in the Land of Israel on the Land of Israel Network. It's February 5th, 2017, the ninth day of Shvat, 5777. You guys always catch me at the beginning of a week where I'm coming out of like my Shabbat reflective mode, I suppose. And this week was a little more than usual. On Thursday, we attended the funeral of a friend, too young, Stephen Essis, Shlomo David ben Pnina, who died in his early 50s of pancreatic cancer, leaving behind a beautiful family and a beautiful legacy of tremendous love, not just for the Jewish people and for the Land of Israel, and most specifically his family and his friends, but also a lot of charitable work that he did, a lot of things that he was involved with, many of which I'm sure most of us will never know. And of course, it gets all of us thinking, A, about how short things can be, how life can end a lot earlier than you anticipated. And that's why you really have to make the most of each day. But also really just standing there thinking that at the end, we all go to the next world. And what we leave behind really is our good name and our children and what we've taught them, what we hope that they bring forward, the combination, like the link in the chain, and the combination of bringing down the traditions that are so important to us, especially as Jews, close to 4,000 years of traditions of faith. And we want that to go down to the next generation. Otherwise, if it ends with us, then, you know, it's the beautiful story of the brilliance of Jacob when he brings Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's sons, when he brings them into the family, right? Because those are the grandchildren who also get part of the inheritance, a large part of the inheritance of the Land of Israel. So what does it matter if Joseph is alive, if they're reunited after all those years, if in the end his children, Ephraim and Manasseh, don't become part of the Am, don't become part of the people? And after all, there would be good reason for them not to be, because they're, you know, the son of an Egyptian woman, probably, and born in Egypt and, you know, raised in Egypt. And so the importance of children and grandchildren and bringing them in to our legacy and our traditions and our faith in any way that, of course, they choose to bring it forward, but how we need to make the effort as much as we can, just like, and I think that's a powerful message that Jacob did, and so powerful that that's the blessing that we give our children on Friday night. The boys is actually in the name of the grandchildren of Ephraim and Manasseh. So, and all that, of course, tied in with the portions of the week that we're reading now and about this soon, you know, the exodus from Egypt and the beginnings of our, you know, sojourn in the desert and getting the Torah and all that. That's so much a part of who we are. In any event, in terms of some of my legacy or some of the things that I think are important and would like to get out there in the time that I have on this earth. So I am putting the finishing touches on my next trip to the States, my next speaking trip to the States, which is going to be in just a few weeks in March. So I figured I would share with you guys where I'll be and when. It's going to be a really eclectic trip. I just have a couple of open days. Otherwise, pretty much everything is set. I'm going to start off in Sacramento. I'll be there on Wednesday, March 15th, maybe Thursday the 16th also. Then I'm going to be in Philadelphia for Shabbat the 17th and 18th. And that, at the moment, I'm not doing any speaking in Philadelphia, but I'm hoping to do a lot of listening. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whom, as you all know, is one of my favorite thinkers, my favorite Jewish philosophers of today, he's going to be there. And I've been invited by a friend who lives in Philadelphia to be her guest at that Shabbat. So I'm really, really excited about that. I'm sure I'm going to have so many wow moments listening to Rabbi Sacks that weekend. And then Sunday is a little bit up in the air. And then Austin on Monday, March 20th, I'm going to be at the Wells Branch Church. On Tuesday, the 21st, I'm going to be in Chicago at Beth Shalom of Northbrook. There's going to be a screening of the film The Settlers and a panel discussion afterwards. Guess what side I'm going to be on, everybody? If you can't stand the suspense and you're in the Chicago area, come and hear me. Then Wednesday, March 22nd, I will be in St. Louis at the Young Israel. And Thursday, travel day. Friday, I will be at APAC for the March 25th through 28th to the Policy Forum in Washington, D.C. So it's going to be like all over the place. One of those, if it's Tuesday, it must be, I don't know, somewhere. Let's see. This case, Tuesday, it must be Chicago. Kind of bopping all over the place and trying to hear from you also, not just bring to you the message and the truth of what's happening here in Israel, which is not very often not what you're hearing, obviously, in your media channels, but also to hear from you and get your questions and communicate and hear your concerns and your caring and your, you know, your worry and your criticisms, whatever it is. Let's have that conversation. So I would love to see all of you, any of you who are out there listening. And like I said, I've still got a couple of days in between that I can parachute out to somewhere, I suppose, on my way to somewhere else. So let me know. Be in touch with me, eve@thelandofisrael.com. As always, happy to hear from you. So we're going to go right into my interview. It's a really nice one with Dr. Ilana Heidemann from the Israel Forever Foundation. Pre-taped it a couple of days ago, and she's really a delight. I hope you think the same. That's it for today's intro. Eve Harrow on the Land of Israel Network. Thanks to Ben and Tabitha and Jeremy and Ari and everybody who gives me this platform to say the things that are close to my heart. So kind of where my head is today, hug the people that you're close to, hug the people that you love. Don't waste too much time with the people that you don't like. Let's, you know, let's make our life not just about quantity and length, but about quality. I think in general, that's the way to go. So have a great week, everybody. And I'll be back, God willing, next week. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation. Goodbye, everybody, for now. Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And I am now with Dr. Ilana Heidemann, who's the Executive Director of the Israel Forever Foundation. So thanks for joining me today, Ilana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is the Israel Forever Foundation?
Well, we are an Israel engagement organization that works to deepen and mobilize the personal connection to Israel for Jews around the world, with such a strong emphasis on advocacy and hasbara and the politics and the conflict. There are so many Jews moving away from wanting any connection to Israel, and we try to remind everybody about the relevance of Israel to Jewish life and identity wherever they might live in the world.
So that's a very strong statement, that there are a lot of Jews moving away from identity with Israel. Why do you say that?
Well, when I was growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, as a young woman, my parents raised us that Israel was very integral to the Jewish identity. It was just a part of who we were and a part of everything that we did. But because Israel has become such a charged topic in every way, you can't even say the name Israel without it being interpreted as something political and for which you must have a side. So we, you know, I think that because of that, people are moving further and further away of believing that Israel has a place in their daily life or that there's a way to connect with it outside of just watching the news. And of course, the news is very important, but we can't expect a Jew who is wherever they are in the world to feel it as intimately as we do because they're juggling many balls. We live in a very overprogrammed, overscheduled generation. And so how do we encourage them to approach Israel in a positive way with some deep thinking, some critical thinking, but also to walk away with something good and meaningful that they can interject into their own lives?
Well, just by virtue of the fact, if you're only going to connect to something through the news, it's usually going to be negative. The news doesn't usually put positive things on. Right. Or there might be just like a little blurb about how Israel is doing something with high tech or water desalination. But in general, if you're seeing Israel in the news, it's going to be in the context of some kind of conflict or something that's going on here in the Middle East.
And unfortunately, all those kind of articles and pieces, and I love the advancements that Israel presents to the world. And we're really, what would the world be without Israel is often a question that we encourage people to consider. But that's not going to change people's minds, that we are above and beyond in the areas of high tech and technology and medical advancements. But that doesn't change people's opinions when they're being confronted with very intense negative accusations about what Israel does or how Israel's existence is the cause for, you know, all the problems. And so they're not a counterbalance. It's they're completely, it's almost too fragmented for them to draw their own connections between, wow, look at water desalinization and what we're doing in Africa. So what? How does that relate to all of these terrible things that I'm hearing about Israel, Israelis, the terrible behavior, the terrible this, the terrible accusations? And so people are just simply saying, I'd rather not be involved. I'd rather not address it other than on Yom HaAtzmaut or in what we call, you know, the blue and white washing. Everything here is so hunky-dory, peachy-keen, which it's not. And we know it's not. And those of us who live here accept that it's not and say, it's, you know, but look at it for its value. And we are constantly improving society and we're constantly working towards that betterment. But when you're far away, you don't care so much. And that's not an accusation. It's simply a statement of fact. It's not this, the Pew report and the distancing. I'm not talking in a clinical sense. I'm talking about a normal, typical Jewish mom, dad, brother, sister, kid in a school who's not in a Jewish day school or who is and is getting the nuanced, so to speak, approach to Israel. You know, we're just really living in a complex time. And sometimes we have to simplify it and say, here are some great ways that you can stay connected. You can hear personal perspectives. You can approach topics like history or contemporary events. And you can do it in a way that you're walking away feeling good about yourself. And we try to do that by recognizing everybody around the world as virtual citizens of Israel, that they should be able to feel a sense of belonging, no matter whether they're living in Australia or California or England or wherever they are in the world. They should be able to say, this is the birthright that I inherit. I am part and parcel of the project that is the nation of Israel. That state of Israel is a part of it, the community of Israel, B'nai Yisrael. And we use these terms when, you know, if they're religious, you use them when we pray. If you're not religious, you still sit at a Passover Seder and say it. So we want to be able to just keep that feeling of connection alive in as many ways as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. And for many people, that sense of Jewish identity is very much hooked into Israel one way or the other. So who started the Israel Forever Foundation?
So we're actually in our bar mitzvah year now. When Danny Aiello was ambassador in the United States, he and actually my parents, Richard and Phyllis Heidemann, Lenny Ben David, and a few other significant people joined together because they wanted to create a nonprofit organization that would focus on highlighting the contributions of Israel to the world. Since then, over the years, we had some small projects, but since then, the vision has changed also as a result of new organizations coming out that did that great. Israel 21C does a phenomenal job and some others. And so we revamped about 6 years ago when I took, after I finished my, my PhD, and I took it over and I wanted to create a system, shall we say, a platform, a portal, so that would address this growing confusion and lack of connection in a positive and meaningful way. So over the last 5-6 years, we've really blossomed. We now have a global community of over 75,000 people. We have a social media following on Facebook of almost 400,000 people and 16,000 on Twitter. So our numbers are growing and entirely organically, actually, which shows that we're contributing something to the Jewish world that they feel they're not getting elsewhere. And nowadays, even newspapers, there are lots of personal articles, personal stories, things like that. But we have this kind of this center for being able to approach Israel in a myriad of ways that address you, whether it's recipes or books or articles that are about memories, the Israel Memory Project. We have our Balfour Initiative. So we have a wide range of topics for content, initiatives, and programming that people can use in their community, in their families, wherever it suits them. Educators use our resources many times. I know that several community leaders have approached me saying that, you know, they've shared a blog with their entire congregation and it was so well received. So we're really trying to reach people in a new way and, you know, always trying to grow that impact as best we can.
So your target audience is Jews around the world. So I have a lot of listeners who are Christians who love Israel and feel very tied to the Jewish people and to Israel, very tied to God and the fact that if the Jewish people are back in Israel, that's like God kind of like, you know, right, saying, I'm here, everybody, take a look, because this, it doesn't really make sense that this happened. Could Christians also find something with what you put out and be part of your world?
Absolutely. We actually have a good number of non-Jewish followers to our content and people who comment consistently and who are recognized as virtual citizens of Israel as well, because we do want it to be all-inclusive, but we aren't willing to forego that belonging that we want all Jews to have with Israel. So whereas we are a global Jewish community and our target audience is the Jewish world, we also believe we have to welcome those non-Jews who are so passionate about Israel and who are so supportive of our rights, our ancestral rights in the land, our rights as Jews in the world, and the need to fight against anti-Semitism. And we need, especially today, with so many Jews moving away from engagement with Israel, we do want to encourage that collaboration with the non-Jewish supporters of Israel. We just want to make sure that we're very protective of, people who like to missionize and people who want to try and say that the Jews are back in Israel because that's going to bring about the return of their Messiah. We are very careful and we try very hard to encourage people who are our non-Jewish followers to say, have respect for who we are as Jews, because your love for Israel should be bound to that as well. It should be bound for who Israel is and who we as Jews are, and that we have a right to our faith and our traditions, and we shouldn't feel a need to be de-Judaized, which unfortunately is happening to many of our communities and many of our initiatives, even in the Jewish world everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. That was a very important point. So you are Dr. Heidemann. What did you earn your PhD?
I got my PhD in Holocaust studies, anti-Semitism, and phenomenology under the guidance of Professor Elie Wiesel.
Wow, no less. He just passed away not long ago either. So tell us a little bit about that. That's fascinating.
I had a tremendous honor of working with him, being invited by him. It's now 16 years ago, and I was the only student of his who worked specifically on the personal experience with the Holocaust. It was tremendously powerful, intense, and the research that I did was focusing primarily on the uniqueness of the Jewish experience during the Holocaust, as opposed to those others who suffered under the tyranny of Nazism. And I do personally, and many educators that I know also, and historians, do feel the need to make that distinction. The Holocaust is the attempted extermination of the Jews in particular, and there are many who suffered under Nazism, but not necessarily in the same way. They were not treated the same, even within the camps. There was a hierarchy of how people were treated, just as there was a hierarchy in the labeling of the undesirables in the Nazi system. So we worked on addressing those issues and how we transmit those messages through education, both formal and informal. It was a tremendous honor to work for him and with him, and I do my best to carry on his legacy in everything that I do.
So possibly not a fair question, but how do you think he would have responded to something that's been in the news the last few days, somewhat of a furor, that would be terrible, what Hitler was called, a lot of noise over what the new Trump administration on International Holocaust Memorial Day, the statement that they gave, kind of a general statement about the victims of the Nazis without specifically singling out the Jews. And a lot of people have gotten upset about that. You have any idea, or maybe just give me your opinion of what Elie Wiesel might have said to that?
Well, I've always been very hesitant to speak in his name. However, I will say that with the absence of the specific reference to Jews, it's important to recognize what we now know, which is that it was written by a Jewish member of staff. What would that mean? Why does that matter? Well, there are two ways to look at it. Either this writer of this speech, either as a Jew, he felt that it was our responsibility to address all of the victims. And again, the number 11 million continues to be used, but it's actually historically inaccurate, and there is no evidence to the 5 million number that people throw around, just like just like 6 million is actually no longer accurate based on new research and increased findings of a much higher number. And there's historians today that some who will say about 7.2 million is what we're looking at. Father Patrick Dubois actually has recently uncovered even more mass graves where we think that number might continue to grow. And again, that's unconfirmed at this time. But this idea of this generalized number is sometimes used by Jews in particular because we feel a need to say, no, it's not just about us. And it could be that this speech writer decided to use that as the, you know, that was the perspective from which he wrote this statement. It could be. It could also be that he said that I, as a Jew, can't interject that Jew when actually January 27th is not Jewish Holocaust Memorial Day. It is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And it was specifically chosen, in my opinion, because it is a de-Judaized memorial date for this historical event. The liberation of Auschwitz was not the liberation of the Jews from their suffering in the Holocaust. The Holocaust did not end. There were already for several months continuing death marches, and you have hundreds of thousands of Jews and others who also continue to die until the end of World War II in the end of May. So January 27th is not a day about the Jews. I absolutely disagree with no mention of the Jews. You have to understand. But as a historian, when I look at how he chose or how that possibly came about as the public statement from the administration, I think that there are some, and I must say, unfortunate logical reasons why it likely happened. I think, however, that it had to happen. Because what's happening today with the discussion on the Holocaust, whether it be the comparisons with the new president and Hitler, which are inane, or the comparisons of Israel and Israeli soldiers as Nazis, or the comparison of the Jewish victims of the Holocaust with non-Jewish victims of the Holocaust, that today these conversations have to happen. Because the Holocaust is being, a student said to me, I feel over-Holocausted. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who feel that way. And so it's either being generalized. So here's the story. It happened to the Jews, but also these millions of others. So really what happened to the Jews is nothing unique. And now the same thing is happening over and over again. And the fact of the matter is, the same thing is not happening. There's very little comparison that actually can be made when you know your facts. But when you generalize, it's very easy. You have the soup Nazi, and you have this Nazi, and you have that Nazi, and Jews throw the word Nazi around all the time amongst ourselves. And it's terrible. And it's a desecration to what was the Holocaust experience, its uniqueness, and it's only diminishing it for future generations. So the reason I think that actually this terrible absence of a reference to Jews at all, the reason I think that there is something good that comes out of it is because we have the opportunity to readdress the topic of the importance of the Holocaust, the uniqueness of the Jewish experience in the Holocaust, the uniqueness of the message of the Holocaust to the world as opposed to other genocides. And mind you, I do speak and teach about all other genocides as well, but I very strongly believe that comparative genocide studies is illegitimate. Each genocide and each suffering of a nation should be studied for its own sake, in its own context, with its own circumstances and its own historical facts embedded. By trying to create a parallel between them, we are shifting history, we are revising the facts, and we are creating a very dangerous situation for the future of Holocaust memory in general.
So I would imagine, given that you have a PhD in Holocaust and are very steeped in knowledge, that you've been to Poland and you've been to Europe quite a few times. Do you lead delegations there? Do you lead groups there? Is that part of your teaching?
It is, and I have been guiding in Poland for, I want to say my first time, I can't even remember, I want to say 19 years ago. I've continued to guide. I guide both with the March of the Living, and I also design and guide my own journeys that I've done for schools and also for private groups, families, and things like that. So they're very, very different. The experience of learning in a classroom is one thing. The experience of learning in a museum. I also guide at Yad Vashem, and I've spent many years prior to my Aliyah, even taking groups through the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. And Poland is an experience all of its own. There are many who are very against the Poland journey. I believe that it is entirely dependent on the educator. And the educator can do a shock system type of experience where it's death, 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 death. Or it can be about Jewish life. What is it that we're supposed to remember from the world before the Holocaust? And how does the Holocaust fit into Jewish history? It's not the only catastrophe we have experienced. It's simply the most documented and one from which we can learn the most intricate lessons because we have so much evidence. You don't hear, most Jews have no clue about the Khmelnytsky massacres in the 1600s. They assume that the Spanish Inquisition was targeting Jews. It was not. There were many, you know, hundreds of thousands of Jews who suffered, but that is not the same. And again, as I mentioned before about comparative genocide studies, the more we learn, it will come from recognizing distinctions and not always trying to find the similarities and simplifying and generalizing. So the Poland journeys are in and of themselves very, very powerful. I believe strongly that it has an asset. I don't think everybody needs to go, but I do continue to go, take some hiatus years with children being born, but I continue to go, and I have, God willing, our next journey happening this year.
Is that open to everybody?
It is, and I feel tremendously honored to be designing and running the official Elie Wiesel Memorial Delegation for this year's March of the Living in the year of his passing. And I will be guiding the journey according to his writing and his lessons and the legacy that we inherit. So the entire trip is going to be incorporating all of those messages that he has transmitted to the world over the years of his leadership as a public Holocaust survivor, especially during a time when not many were. The trip is open to the public, and you can find information about it at linksinthechain.org or israelforever.org. We have the information on both websites. And it will be a tremendously, tremendously powerful experience. And hopefully if it goes well and we are successful in recruiting the complete group, then we'll be able to make it an annual experience, God willing.
So I also had that experience. For me, one time was enough to go to Poland. But to some degree, you are working against the clock here. I mean, when I grew up, some of my friends, their parents were survivors. So, you know, they would come to school. Either they spoke Hungarian at home. One of my good friends spoke Hungarian at home. Sometimes she would slip and speak Hungarian in school. But they were waking up sometimes in the middle of the night hearing people yelling, yeah, you know, with the nightmares. They had no grandparents or cousins or aunts and uncles. That generation is now, we have every single day, hundreds of survivors die. And I would imagine that your challenge as a fairly young woman is to keep this alive, even what happened in the Holocaust, even when we have no survivors or no witnesses to the actual experience alive, which within, I would imagine, 10 years or so, I mean, the Holocaust is over 70 years. I would imagine within a decade or so, there are going to be very few, if any, who actually saw what happened. And we already have Holocaust denial in the world. How are you preparing for this next stage of Holocaust education?
There are a variety of efforts that are in place from different museums and educational institutions around the world on answering that question in particular. How do we face the next generation in the absence of Holocaust survivors and eyewitness experiences? Most people of the next generation will never have met a survivor. Many people that I teach today have never met a survivor, which is, people find surprising that still today, while there are survivors, they still have not met one because the opportunities are not as public. And one of the reasons I think that that's also happening is because of what I mentioned before, which is the tendency towards the de-Judaizing of the Holocaust experience. It's no longer just about the Jews. And not only is it not just about them, it's as if we can't interject. We're not allowed to interject the uniqueness of the Jewish experience. I think that as we move towards the next decade or two, Holocaust education needs to and Holocaust educators need to employ more reflective methods of Holocaust education. And this is, again, a topic on which that I not only studied with Wiesel, but have spoken about and tried to write about on occasion. Reflection with the Holocaust means I'm not just hearing the stories, but I am internalizing them in a way that allows me to carry on. Elie Wiesel, and it's a quote that everybody uses and passes around, has said that he who listens to a witness, or she who listens to a witness, becomes a witness. If you were to ask a large number of your friends if they've ever met a Holocaust survivor, and they will say yes, and you say, well, what was their name? They will not be able to tell you. If you ask them, do you remember their story? They will not be able to tell you. So while Holocaust memory transmission increased over the last 30 to 40 years, and Holocaust education and formal methods has increased over the last 20 to 30 years, we're not seeing those memories captured in a personal way, that they are then being transmitted by the listener. And I believe that that's something that we need to employ more seriously over the next decade or two to ensure that the personal story can be transmitted in a very effective way. There are in Israel a very high percentage of second generation who are taking on the responsibility of passing on the memories. In the diaspora, it's less so because second generation often has felt it's documented, a tension between the parent and the grandparent, the parent and the child, the parent who's a survivor and the child, but the grandchildren have started to take it on. And actually, I've done some counseling even with fourth generation who are looking at how they can take it, because they're now the bar and bat mitzvah kids who are saying, how do I, my God, but their grandparent has already passed. So how do they capture it? Because they go to the parent, and the parent didn't ask, and they didn't know. So what we have to do is, all of the videos, they're wonderful, and they're important, but how we use them has yet to be really explored in a dynamic way that will make sure it's not just, and for, it sounds kind of crass, but here I am sitting and watching a video of an old person talking about their life. Because that's a lot of the response that young people sometimes have. It's emotional. You might get sad. But we cannot measure Holocaust memory and its effectiveness in being an impetus for human improvement, the dynamics between humanity. We can't expect that because they cried. Your tears are never a measure of what you learned, whether you're at Yad Vashem or in Poland or in a class. The tears are great. They're important because it shows you have empathy. But if we want to transmit the Holocaust memories to future generations, we have to take a more active role in it, and we have to be very specific of what we are asking of the next generation. Not just remember the Holocaust, and not just don't forget to mention the Jews, but what is it? If you want to make sure that the Holocaust does not stop, it does not happen in the future, be very specific of what a Nazi is. Be very specific. Most people, for example, will focus so much on Auschwitz, but mention nothing about the Operation Reinhardt camps. That these camps, where it was Jews and only Jews, and we have this amazing testimony by Rudolf Redder, who was the sole survivor of Belzec's extermination camp. And he writes, Jews and only Jews. And he says this, and it's so powerful, because even as Elie Wiesel once said, not all victims were Jews, but all Jews were victims. Well, in the extermination centers, with the exception of very specific testing groups, all victims were Jews. Only Jews were put on cattle cars. And I always, always emphasize, only Jews were put in ghettos. Only Jews were labeled prior to their incarceration to the concentration and labor camps, because there, yes, you do have a wide variety of populations that suffered. But concentration camps are nothing new. Labor camps are nothing new in history. It is the extermination process that was new, the systemization that was new, and it was all specifically targeted only for Jews. If a Jew does not feel confident, or even a non-Jew, feel confident to address the uniqueness, then in 20, 40, 60, 100 years, the Holocaust is going to be just a dot in the map of history no one will care. And unfortunately, we might see once again another upheaval against Jews. And we're seeing the upheaval of hate right now. But the upheaval of violence and an attempt to destroy, which we here in Israel, we know, we hear it every day, the desire to wipe us out. And we see people ignoring it, just like they ignored it in the past. I'm very, very careful. I do not equate Jewish refugees during the time under Hitler with the refugees of today. Sure, of course, there are similarities. But that does not mean that we can create such a generalization. And again, those generalizations, they are the most dangerous thing in the future. We have a plethora of books by Holocaust survivor memoirs. Nobody's reading them. And if they are, recently I was speaking and somebody, I had started telling a very powerful story that I tell of a woman that I knew. May she rest in peace. And they said, oh, I've heard the story before. And I looked at the 19-year-old, and I said, you've heard this story before? Oh, yeah, I'm sure of it. Really, you're so sure. As a 19-year-old, student who went to a Jewish school, by the way, where the Holocaust class was an elective. So he had never actually studied the Holocaust. Came with me on a private visit at Yad Vashem. Never knew a fact at all. This is a religious Jewish student, very bright, so passionate, and afterwards felt so bad. Why didn't I take that class? Well, because it was either taking this or taking something that interests you more. So, mandatory Holocaust education has its dilemmas. Unfortunately, I see a tendency towards mandatory Holocaust education actually creating some resentment towards Jews and hatred towards Jews. But within the Jewish world, if it's not done right, then we're going to lose our own, and imena nili mili, if we're not for ourselves. So we need to make sure that every Jew inherits this and says, I know the lesson I am transmitting. And again, that also becomes generalized, because nowadays Holocaust memory is, how do we transfer that legacy to helping others? But we are still we're not helping ourselves. And that's
so there are a couple of points here. One, for those who aren't familiar, Yad Vashem is the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. And it's very different than other Holocaust museums, and I've been to quite a few. It makes the stories personal, very much so. And it also focuses to a great deal on the life that was lost, the entire world that was lost after the Holocaust, that entire Yiddish-speaking world of Jews that had existed for well over a millennia just completely disappeared. So not just the people were killed, but an entire way of life was wiped out. And we're like now in this generation in between, and then a few years later, the modern day state of Israel is born. So there's been so much going on in the past 60, 70 years for Jews that I can see how young people might be faced with so many messages. Among them are messages that all of humanity is the same. Like, we're seeing how us being nationalistic here in Israel is not going over very well within a European Union that's trying to erase all the borders, and there's no distinct Italians or Dutch anymore. Everybody's just a European. I think there's a bit of a pushback now to that with Brexit, and I would even say with the new American administration, that patriotism should not be a bad word. People can feel distinctly unique. And the question is, I think, for the people, kids growing up now, who are so completely also overwhelmed with information and to some degree inured to violence, because so much of their video games and television shows and movies that they watch are so violent that at some point it's just not going to hit you the way that it should anymore, because you're always seeing people get blown up. What is the big deal?
Unless, and it's exactly for that reason, that the context is crucial. So, you can be as desensitized as you want. But when you hear the stories of places like throughout Lithuania, like in Ponar and Zbilatowska Góra in southern Poland, and you hear the stories of the treatment of babies. Yeah. Wiesel once said, one can love music and still murder babies. Yes.
Well, it was the most cultured people in the world at the time, the Germans, who did the Holocaust. But when I came back to Israel from Poland, I remember understanding, and I understood it anyway, which is why I'm here, how important Israel is. Not just because we have an army and we can keep ourselves safe, but because we are, to some degree, bringing back a Jewish society can't replace the one that was lost, and it's very different. We're speaking Hebrew, not Yiddish. Mm-hmm. But there's a living society now here of Jews. There's a living country of Jews. And I we only have a couple minutes left, but I see that you're doing the same thing. I mean, hear your background. You have a PhD in Holocaust studies, yet the foundation that you're the executive director of is not a Holocaust foundation. You do that also. But it's called the Israel Forever Foundation, and you focus very much on the positive in Israel and connecting people to the living and breathing modern-day country and to Jewish identity. So you, I think you yourself are encompassing both of that. Like, this is what was, and we cannot forget, and we have to make sure to understand and learn that history, but the focus is on the future. Is that what you see that you're doing here? Because I see this really clearly.
Yeah, no, I do. I think that, first of all, thank you, because I think that's a beautiful way of expressing it. You know, people have always said to me, you know, for somebody who works with the Holocaust, it's now 28, 29 years that I've been immersed in the Holocaust with my life. It started very, very young. And when people say how I came to it, I always say, you know, this is what Hashem gave me to do. My work with Israel Forever, I believe, is born out of that. And Israel is, when we define Israel at Israel Forever, it's not just the state. It's everything that Israel is and has been throughout the history of our nation. And the Holocaust is part and parcel of that. And I want to always emphasize how they tie together. And so I do that a few times a year. I don't believe it should be relegated, certainly not to the UN selected date, and not only to Yom HaShoah either, but that it should be an ongoing part of our lives, and not only through its sadness. And so a lot of people have said to me over the years, for somebody who's been with the Holocaust all of her life, you're really a smiley, happy person. It is actually my studies with the Holocaust that have driven me in my faith and in my positivity, because I do see what is possible from humanity, even in the worst of times, and dafka even more so during good times, and that we have to be able to look at even the most challenging, look at the division happening in the Jewish world today. This isn't the first time in history this has happened. You know, when Hitler was elected, do you know how many Jews in Germany voted for Hitler? So I think that the comparison with Trump is inane. This isn't a pro-Trump, anti. I don't even make statements like that because I think it's irrelevant. But I do think that we need to recognize this isn't the first division in Jewish history between our nation, national members, shall we say. It's not going to be the last. The most important thing we need to recognize is how can we repair any rifts between our communities, whether they're local or global. And when we look at the Holocaust, we should not only focus on its sadness, but focus on the legacy that we inherit, just like we do that for Pesach, when we sit around at the Seder, just like we can do that for Tu B'Shvat. You know, I wrote a Tu B'Shvat Seder, actually, for anyone interested in the upcoming holiday for Tu B'Shvat, a celebration of the land, because we can't celebrate Tu B'Shvat without recognizing that this is a thousands-year-old...
The birthday for the trees.
The birthday of Israel's trees, a thousand-year-old connection of the Jewish land. And so just like we sit around and we have these ceremonial celebrations or prayers or whatever, we should do the same with the Holocaust and make it not just a ceremony, but just a part of who we are and how we are, and Israel should be the same. We often say that at Israel Forever, we are trying to foster Israel-inspired Jewish identity, and as I said, that's how I was raised in Louisville, Kentucky. I said to a friend of mine who was starting a community school, let me write a curriculum for you, let me write a program for you to do with your new school, and she said, Ilana, we just want to raise our kids to be good Jews. There's no room for Israel in that. And this was just a few
years
ago.
That is terrible.
And it was one of the things that really drove me to build Israel Forever to what we are today, that cannot be the case. You cannot separate Israel out just because you disagree with this action or that act. We're still Israel, even if we disagree. It makes us even more Israel because we disagree.
And this is our ancient homeland.
This is our ancient homeland, and we are an ancient people, and we need to incorporate into our legacy that we transmit for the next 1,000 years of Jewish life. We need to make sure that regardless of our disagreements, regardless of our location in the world, we never become divorced, not from the Kotel, the Wailing Wall, not from the place of our of Avraham and the near sacrifice of Isaac, not the Temple Mount, whatever you want to call it, not Judea and Samaria, which with whatever might be established in terms of a political state, that land remains our ancestral homeland. The cave of our forefathers, Ma'arat HaMachpelah in Hebron, we have this historical evidence, because you can look at the Bible and religiously, or you can look at it as a historical document. We have evidence the land was bought, the land was paid for. These are our ancestors. If you let your political division with the current situation dictate how you feel about this land, then what will your children know about our ancestral inheritance, our birthright in 1,000 years? And the Jewish people aren't going anywhere. And they, another Amalek and another generation of enemies is always going to continue to say, we're going to get rid of you and you're going to do this and you should be ashamed for being a Jew. And we have to make sure that pride carries us through, that honor, that dignity of being a Jew, being proud to be a Jew, being proud of what we accomplish as a nation, those same technological developments of Israel, we should be proud. Yes, because it's the Jewish genius. That is Abba Eban once questioned, what will happen to the Jewish genius once we are in our own land? And look at what has happened. And
so light into the nations. Yeah. Absolutely, the light into the nations. So there's a lot of balancing to be done here. I know some people who say, well, I'm Jewish because 6 million of us were killed. And I think that is the saddest thing. That's why you're Jewish, because we're hated. So we have to recognize the hatred, learn about the causes of the hatred, make sure that it doesn't get out of bounds so that something like the Holocaust happens again, God forbid, and people are killed because they're Jews. But not focus on that as that's who our identity is. There's so much positive to being Jewish, and it's really the balance. But I think anyone who's listening has that in their personal lives. Everyone's had the people who didn't like them and the difficult relationships that they've had, but does that define who you are? Or do you learn from them, you take strength from them, and with God's help, you move forward and see the positive and work to make the positive changes while not forgetting and integrating the bad times as well? And as the Jewish people, I think we know that. It's been 3,500 years of a very bumpy road. But we're still here and we're home again and we're doing really wonderful things. So thank you so much, Dr. Ilana Heidemann and the Israel Forever Foundation. Where can people find you if they're interested, not only in the trip, the delegation that you have in memory, in honor of Elie Wiesel, but some of the other work that you do, the blogs, the positive things? What is the website?
Israelforever.org. Come visit. Come visit every day. There's always something new. Just follow us on Facebook. You will be amazed. Our Twitter we actually use as the feed for the best of what to read on Israel. So we really try to provide an eclectic selection. We curate very carefully. So Israelforever.org, make it your home for Israel engagement today and every day.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Ben and to Tabitha and everyone else at the Land of Israel Network. Write to me. Love hearing from you guys. Eve@thelandofisrael.com. Have a great week, everybody. Goodbye for now.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center, with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with HaYovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to HaYovel.com.